Exactly. Timing is a sensitive thing. Where's Poppet? Bailey asks. Miss Penelope is indisposed at the moment. How can she not know that I'm here? He asks. She might very well know you are here, but that does not change the fact that she is, as I have mentioned, indisposed at the moment. Who are you? Bailey asks. His shoulder is throbbing now, and he cannot quite pinpoint when everything stopped making sense. You may call me Tsukiko, the contortionist says. She takes a long drag on her cigarette. Beyond her, the monstrous bowl of wrought iron curls sits hollow and still. The ground around it, usually painted in a spiral pattern of black and white, is now nothing but darkness, as though it has been swallowed up by empty space. I thought the fire never went out, Bailey says, walking closer to it. It never has before, Tsukiko says. Reaching the edge of the still hot iron curls, Bailey stands on his toes to peer inside. It is almost filled with rainwater, the dark surface rippling in the breeze. The ground beneath his feet is black and muddy, and when he steps back, he accidentally kicks a black bowler hat. What happened? Bailey asks. That is somewhat difficult to explain, Tsukiko answers. It is a long and complicated story. And you're not going to tell it to me, are you? She tilts her head a bit, and Bailey can see the hint of a smile playing around her lips. No, I am not, she says. Great, Bailey mutters under his breath. I see you have taken up the banner, Tsukiko says, pointing her cigarette at his red scarf. Bailey is unsure how to respond to this, but she continues without waiting for an answer. I suppose you could call it an explosion. The bonfire exploded? How? Remember when I said it was difficult to explain? That has not changed. Why didn't the tents burn? Bailey asks, looking around at the seemingly never-ending stripes. Some of the closer tents are splattered with mud, but none are burned, despite the charred ground surrounding them. That was Miss Bowen's doing, Tsukiko says. I suspect without that precaution there would have been more extensive damage. Who is Miss Bowen? Bailey asks. You ask a lot of questions, Tsukiko responds. You don't answer very many of them, Bailey retaliates. The smile appears in full then, curling up in a manner Bailey finds almost disturbingly friendly. I am only an emissary, Tsukiko says. I am here to act as convoy to escort you to a meeting for a discussion of such matters, I suppose, because at the moment I am the only living person who has any idea of what has transpired and why you are here. Your questions are better saved for someone else. And who might that be? Bailey asks. You shall see, Tsukiko says. Come this way. She beckons him forward, leading him around the bonfire to the other side of the courtyard. They walk a short way down an adjoining passageway, layers of mud sticking to Bailey's formerly shiny shoes. Here we are. Tsukiko stops at a tent entrance, and Bailey moves closer to check the sign, knowing which tent it is as soon as he glances at the words upon it. Fearsome beasts and strange creatures, wonders in paper and mist. Are you coming with me? Bailey asks. No, Tsukiko says. Only an emissary, remember? I shall be in the courtyard if you need me. With that, she gives him a polite nod and walks back the way they came, and as Bailey watches her go, he notices that the mud is not sticking to her boots. After she disappears around a corner, Bailey enters the tent. Incendiary. New York, October 31, 1902. Marco's back slams against the ground as though he has been roughly pushed, leaving him coughing both from the impact and the cloud of black ash surrounding him. A light rain is falling as he pulls himself up, and as the air around him clears, he sees a row of tiny trees and stars surrounded by silver gears and black and white chess pieces. It takes him a moment to realize he is standing next to the Wunschtraum clock. The clock is ticking toward midnight, the harlequin juggler at the top balancing 11 balls amongst the twinkling stars and moving pieces. The sign announcing the circus's closure due to inclement weather clatters in the wind, though for the moment the rain is not much more than a heavy mist. Marco rubs the shimmering powder from his face, which has reverted to its true form, and he is too disoriented to change it. He tries to get a better look at the dark ash on his suit, but it is already fading away. The striped curtain beyond the ticket booth hangs open, and through the haze, Marco can see a figure standing in the shadows, illuminated by the sharp spark of light from a cigarette lighter. "Bonsoir," Tsukiko says cheerfully as he approaches, tucking her lighter back in her pocket as she balances her cigarette in its long silver holder. A rush of wind howls across the space, rattling the circus gates.
How did she do this?" Marco asks.
"Isabel, you mean," Tsukiko replies. "I taught her that particular trick. I do not think she understood the nuances of it, but it appears she performed fine, regardless. Do you feel unsteady at all?"
"I'm fine," Marco says, though his back is aching from the fall and his eyes still sting.
He watches Tsukiko curiously. He has never spoken at any great length with the contortionist, and her presence is almost as confusing as the fact that moments ago he had been somewhere else entirely.
"Here, come out of the wind at least."
Tsukiko motions him into the curtained tunnel with her cigarette-free hand. "That is a better face than the other one," she says, scrutinizing his appearance through mist and smoke. "It suits you." She lets the curtain fall once he has entered, leaving them enclosed in darkness, studded with dimly sparkling lights, the glowing tip of her cigarette the one spot of color amongst the dots of white.
"Where is everyone?" Marco asks, shaking the rain from his bowler hat.
"Inclement weather party," Tsukiko explains, "traditionally held in the acrobat's tent, as it is the largest. But you would not know that, as you are not truly a member of the company, are you?"
He cannot see her expression well enough to read it, though he can tell that she is grinning brightly. "No, I suppose I am not," he says.
He follows her as she walks through the maze-like tunnel, moving deeper into the circus.
"Why am I here?" he asks.
"We will get to that in due time," she says.
"How much did Isabel tell you?"
The conversation with Isabel outside his building is almost lost in Marco's memory, despite occurring only moments ago. He recalls fleeting pieces of it, nothing coherent enough to articulate.
"No matter," Tsukiko says, when he does not respond immediately. "It is sometimes difficult to gather one's senses after such a journey. Did she tell you that we have something in common?"
Marco recalls Isabel mentioning Celia and someone else, but not who, exactly.
"No," he says.
"We are both former students of the same instructor," Tsukiko says. The end of her cigarette glows brighter as she inhales in the near darkness.
"Temporary cover only, I am afraid," she adds as they reach another curtain.
She pulls it back, and the space is flooded with glowing light from the courtyard. She gestures for Marco to step out into the rain, taking a drag from her cigarette as he obediently walks through the open curtain, trying to make sense of her last statement. The lights that adorn the tents are dark, but in the center of the courtyard, the bonfire burns brightly, glowing and white. The soft rain falling around it glistens.
"It is lovely,"
Tsukiko says, stepping into the courtyard with him.
"I will grant you that." "You were a former student of Alexander's?"
Marco asks, not certain he has understood. Tsukiko nods.
"I tired of writing things in books, so I began inscribing them on my body instead. I am not fond of getting my hands dirty,"
she says, indicating his ink-stained fingers.
"I am surprised he agreed to such an open venue for this challenge. He always preferred seclusion. I suspect he is not pleased with the way it has progressed. As he listens to her, Marco notices that the contortionist is completely dry. Every drop of rain that falls on her evaporates instantly, sizzling into steam as soon as it touches her. "You won the last game," he says. "I survived the last game," Tsukiko corrects. "When?" Marco asks as they walk toward the bonfire. "It ended 83 years, 6 months, and 21 days ago. It was a cherry blossom day." Tsukiko takes a long drag from her cigarette before she continues. "Our instructors do not understand how it is," she says, "to be bound to someone in such a way. They are too old, too out of touch with their emotions. They no longer remember what it is to live and breathe within the world. They think it's simple to pit any two people against each other. It is never simple. The other person becomes how you define your life, how you define yourself. They become as necessary as breathing. Then they expect the victor to continue on without that. It would be like pulling the Murray twins apart and expecting them to be the same. They would be whole but not complete. You love her, do you not?" "More than anything in the world," Marco says. Tsukiko nods thoughtfully. "My opponent's name was Hinata," she says. "Her skin smelled of ginger and cream. I loved her more than anything in the world as well. On that cherry blossom day, she set herself on fire, ignited a pillar of flame, and stepped into it as though it were water." "I'm sorry," Marco says. "Thank you," Tsukiko says, with a shadow of her normally bright smile. "It is what Miss Bowen is planning to do for you. To let you win."
"I know. I would not wish such pain on anyone, to be the victor. Hinata would have adored this," she says, as they reach the bonfire, watching the flames dance in the increasing rain. "She was quite fond of fire. Water was always my element before."
She holds out her hand and watches as the raindrops refuse to reach her skin.
"Do you know the story of the wizard in the tree?" she asks.
"The Merlin story?" Marco asks. "I know several versions."
"There are many," Tsukiko says with a nod. "Old stories have a habit of being told and retold and changed. Each subsequent storyteller puts his or her mark upon it. Whatever truth the story once had is buried in bias and embellishment. The reasons do not matter as much as the story itself."
The rain continues to increase, falling heavily as she continues.
"Sometimes it is a cave, but I like the version with the tree. Perhaps a tree is more romantic."
She takes the still glowing cigarette from its holder, balancing it gently between her graceful fingers.
"While there are a number of trees here that could be used for this purpose," she says, "I thought this might be more appropriate."
Marco turns his attention to the bonfire. It illuminates the rain falling over it in such a way that the droplets of water sparkle like snow. All the versions of the Merlin story he knows involve the magician being imprisoned in a tree or a cave or a rock. Always as a punishment, the consequence of a foolish love. He looks back at Tsukiko.
"You understand," she says, before he can speak.
Marco nods.
"I knew you would," she says.
The light from the white flames brightens her smile through the rain.
"What are you doing, Tsukiko?"
a voice calls from behind her. When Tsukiko turns, Marco can see Celia standing at the edge of the courtyard. Her moonlight gown is soaked to a dull grey. Its crisscrossing ribbons stream out behind her in trails of black and white and charcoal, tangling with her hair in the wind.
"Go back to the party, dear," Tsukiko says, tucking the silver cigarette holder in her pocket. "You will not want to be here for this."
"For what?"
Celia says, staring at Marco. When Tsukiko speaks, she addresses them both. I have been surrounded by love letters you two have built each other for years, encased in tents. It reminds me of what it was to be with her. It is wonderful and it is terrible. I am not yet prepared to give it up, but you are letting it fade. You told me love was fickle and fleeting, Celia says, confused. I lied, Tsukiko says, rolling her cigarette between her fingers. I thought it might be easier if you doubted him, and I gave you a year to find a way for the circus to continue without you. You have not. I am stepping in. I am trying... Celia starts, but Tsukiko cuts her off. You continue to overlook a simple fact, she says. You carry this circus within yourself. He uses the fire as a tool. You are the greater loss, but too selfish to admit it. You believe you could not live with the pain. Such pain is not lived with. It is only endured. I am sorry. Kiko, please, Celia says. I need more time. Tsukiko shakes her head. I told you before, she says. Time is not something I can control. Marco has not taken his eyes from Celia since she appeared in the courtyard, but now he turns away.
Go ahead, he says to Tsukiko, shouting over the growing din of the rain. Do it! I would rather burn by her side than live without her.
What might have been a simple cry of the word no is distorted into something greater by the wind as Celia screams. The agony in her voice cuts through Marco like every blade in Chandrish's collection combined, but he keeps his attention on the contortionist.
It will end the game, yes? He asks. It will end the game, even if I am trapped in the fire and not dead.
You will be unable to continue, Tsukiko says. That is all that matters.
Then do it, Marco says.
Tsukiko smiles at him. She places her palms together, curls of smoke from her cigarette rising over her fingers. She gives him a low, respectful bow. Neither of them are watching as Celia runs toward them through the rain. Tsukiko flicks her still-glowing cigarette toward the fire. It is still in the air when Marco cries out for Celia to stop. It has barely touched the flickering white flames of the bonfire when she leaps into his arms. Marco knows he does not have the time to push her away, so he pulls her close, burying his face in her hair, his bowler hat torn from his head by the wind. And then the pain starts, sharp, ripping pain as though he is being pulled apart.
Trust me,
Celia whispers in his ear, and he stops fighting it, forgetting everything but her. In the moment before the explosion, before the white light becomes too blinding to discern precisely what is happening, they dissolve into the air. One moment they are there, Celia's dress fluttering in the wind and the rain, Marco's hands pressed against her back, and the next they are only a blur of light and shadow. Then both of them are gone, and the circus is ablaze, flames licking against the tents, twisting up into the rain. Alone in the courtyard, Tsukiko sighs. The flames pass by her without touching, swirling around in a vortex, illuminating her with impossible brightness. Then, as quickly as they came, the flames die down to nothing. The bonfire's curling cage sits empty. Not even a smoldering ember remains. The rain patters in a hollow echo against the metal, drops evaporating into steam where the iron is still hot. Tsukiko pulls another cigarette from her coat, flicking open her lighter with a lazy, practiced gesture. The flame catches easily, despite the rain. She watches the cauldron fill with water while she waits. Transmutation. New York, November 1. 1902. If Celia could open her mouth, she would scream. But there is too much to control between the heat and the rain and Marco in her arms. She focuses only on him, pulling everything that he is with her as she breaks herself apart, holding on to the memory of every touch of his skin against hers, every moment she has spent with him, carrying him with her. Suddenly, there is nothing. No rain, no fire, a stretch of calm, white nothingness. Somewhere in the nothingness, a clock begins to strike midnight. Stop, she thinks. The clock continues to chime, but she feels the stillness fall. The breaking is the easy part, Celia realizes. The pulling back together is the problem. It is like healing her sliced open fingertips as a child, taken to an extreme. There is so much to balance, trying to find the edges again. It would be so simple to let go. It would be so much easier to let go. So much less painful. She fights against the temptation, against the pain and the chaos, struggling for control with herself and her surroundings. She picks a location to focus on, the most familiar place she can think of, and slowly, agonizingly slowly, she pulls herself safely together. Until she is standing in her own tent, in the center of a circle of empty chairs. She feels lighter, diluted, slightly dizzy. But she is not an echo of her former self. She is whole again, breathing. She can feel her heart beating, fast but steady. Even her gown feels the same as it did, cascading around her and no longer wet from the rain. She spins in a circle and it flares out around her. The dizziness begins to fade as she collects herself, still amazed at the accomplishment. Then she notices that everything in the tent around her is transparent. The chairs, the lights hanging above her head, even the stripes on the wall seem insubstantial. And she is alone. For Marco, the moment of the explosion lasts much longer. The heat and the light stretch endlessly as he clings to Celia through the pain. And then she is gone. Nothing remains. No fire, no rain, no ground beneath his feet. His sight begins to shift continuously from shadow to light, darkness replaced by expansive white, only to be consumed by darkness again, never settling. The circus shifts around Celia, as fluid as one of Marco's illusions. She pictures where she wishes to be within it, and she is there. She cannot even tell if she is moving herself or manipulating the circus around her. The ice garden is silent and still, nothing but crisp, cool whiteness in every direction. Only a fraction of the hall of mirrors reflects her own countenance, and some contain only a shimmering blur of pale green gown, or the motion of the billowing ribbons as they float behind her. She thinks she catches glimpses of Marco in the glass, the edge of his jacket, or the bright flash of his collar, but she cannot be certain. Many of the mirrors sit hollow and empty within their ornate frames. The mist in the menagerie slowly dissipates as she searches the tent, finding nothing concealed within it but paper. The pool of tears does not even ripple, the surface calm and smooth, and she is unable to grasp a stone to drop within it. She cannot light a candle on the wishing tree, though the wishes that hang on its branches continue to burn. She moves through room after room in the labyrinth, rooms she created leading to ones he made, and back again. She can feel him, close enough that she expects him around each turn, behind each door. But there are only softly drifting feathers and fluttering playing cards, silver statues with unseeing eyes, chessboard-painted floors with vacant squares. There are traces of him everywhere, but nothing for her to focus on, nothing to hold on to. The hallway, lined with mismatched doors and covered in fallen snow, bears traces of what could be footprints, or might only be shadows. And Celia cannot tell where they lead. Marco gasps as air fills his lungs, as though he had been underwater and unaware of it. And his first coherent thought is that he did not expect being trapped in a fire to feel so cold. The cool air is sharp and stinging, and he can see only white in all directions. As his eyes adjust, he can discern the shadow of a tree, the hanging branches of a frosty white willow tree cascading around him. He takes a step forward, the ground disconcertingly soft beneath his feet. He stands in the middle of the ice garden. The fountain in the center has halted, the normally bubbling water quiet and still. And the whiteness makes the effect difficult to see, but the entire garden is transparent. He looks down at his hands. They are shaking slightly, but they appear to be solid. His suit remains dark and opaque. Marco lifts his hand to a nearby rose, and his fingers pass through its petals, with only a soft resistance, as though they are made of water rather than ice. He is still looking at the rose when he hears a gasp behind him. Celia holds her hands to her lips, not quite believing her eyes. The sight of Marco standing in the ice garden is one she has imagined so many times before while alone in the icy expanse of flowers. It does not seem real despite the darkness of his suit against a bower of pale roses. Then he turns and looks at her. As soon as she sees his eyes, all her doubts vanish. For a moment, he looks so young that she can see the boy he was years before she met him, when they were already connected but still so far apart. There are so many things she wants to say, things she feared she would never have the opportunity to tell him again. Only one seems truly important.
"I love you," she says.
The words echo throughout the tent, softly rustling the frozen leaves. Marco only stares at her as she approaches, thinking her a dream.
"I thought I'd lost you,"
she says when she reaches him, her voice a tremulous whisper. She seems to be as substantial as he is, not transparent like the garden. She appears rich and vibrant against a background of white, a bright flush in her cheeks, her dark eyes brimming with tears. He brings his hand to her face, petrified that his fingers will pass through her as easily as they had with the rose. The relief, when she is solid and warm and alive to his touch, is overwhelming. He pulls her into his arms, his tears falling onto her hair.
"I love you,"
he says when he finds his voice. They stand entwined, each unwilling to release the other.
"I couldn't let you do it," Celia says. "I couldn't let you go."
"What did you do?"
Marco asks. He is still not entirely certain he understands what has happened.
"I used the circus as a touchstone," Celia says. "I didn't know if it would work, but I couldn't let you go. I had to try. I tried to take you with me, and then I couldn't find you, and I thought I'd lost you."
"I'm here," Marco says, stroking her hair. "I'm here."
It is not what he expected, being liberated from the world and reinstated in a confined location. He does not feel confined, only separate, as though he and Celia are overlapping the circus rather than contained within it. He looks around at the trees, the long frosted willow branches cascading down, the topiaries that line the nearby path like ghosts. Only then does he notice that the garden is melting.
"The bonfire went out," Marco says.
He can feel it now, the emptiness. He can feel the circus all around him, as though it hangs on him like mist, like he could reach out and touch the iron fence despite the distance from it. Detecting the fence, how far it is in every direction, where every tent sits, even the darkened courtyard and Tsukiko standing within it, is almost effortless. He can feel the entirety of the circus as easily as feeling his shirt against his skin. And the only thing burning brightly within it is Celia. But it is a flickering brightness, as fragile as a candle flame.
"You're holding the circus together," he says.
Celia nods. It is only beginning to weigh on her, but it is much more difficult to manage without the bonfire. She cannot focus enough to keep the details intact. Elements are already slipping away, dripping like the flowers around them. And she knows that if it breaks, she will not be able to put it back together again. She is shaking, and though she steadies when Marco holds her tighter, She continues to tremble in his arms.
Let go of it, Celia.
I can't,
she says.
If I let go, it will collapse.
What will happen to us if it collapses?
Marco asks.
I don't know,
Celia says.
I suspended it. It can't be self-sufficient without us. It needs a caretaker.
Suspended. New York, November 1, 1902. The last time Bailey entered this particular tent, Poppet was with him, and it was filled with a dense white fog. Then, and Bailey has difficulty believing it was only days ago, the tent had seemed endless. But now, without the cover of mist, Bailey can see the white walls of the tent and all the creatures within it, but none of them are moving. Birds and bats and butterflies hang throughout the space as if held by strings, completely still. No rustling of paper wings, no motion at all. Other creatures sit on the ground near Bailey's feet, including a black cat crouched, pre-pounced near a silver-tipped white fox. There are larger animals as well, a zebra with perfectly contrasting stripes, a reclining lion with a snowy mane, a white stag with tall antlers. Standing next to the stag is a man in a dark suit. He is almost transparent, like a ghost or a reflection in glass. Parts of his suit are no more than shadows. Bailey can see the stag clearly through the sleeve of his jacket. Bailey is debating whether or not it is a figment of his imagination when the man looks over at him, his eyes surprisingly bright, though Bailey cannot discern their color.
I asked her not to send you this way, he says, though it is the most direct.
Who are you? Bailey asks.
My name is Marco, the man says. You must be Bailey.
Bailey nods.
I wish you were not so young, Marco says.
Something in his voice sounds profoundly sad, but Bailey is still distracted by his ghost-like appearance.
Are you dead?
He asks, walking closer. With the changing angle, Marco appears almost solid one moment, and transparent again the next.
Not precisely, Marco says.
Tsukiko said she was the only living person here who knew what happened.
I suspect Miss Tsukiko is not always entirely truthful.
You look like a ghost, Bailey says.
He can think of no better way to describe it.
You appear the same way to me, so which of us is real?
Bailey has no idea how to answer that question, so he asks the first one of his own that comes to mind instead.
Is that your bowler hat in the courtyard?
To his surprise, Marco smiles.
It is indeed, he says. I lost it before everything happened, so it got left behind.
What happened? Bailey asks.
Marco pauses before he answers.
That is a rather long story.
That's what Tsukiko said, Bailey says. He wonders if he can find widgets so he can do the storytelling properly.
She was truthful on that point, then, Marco says. Tsukiko intended to imprison me in the bonfire, the reasons for which are a longer story than we have time for, and there was a change of plan that resulted in the current situation. I was pulled apart and put back together again in a less concentrated state.
Marco holds out his hand and Bailey reaches to touch it. His fingers move through without stopping, but there is a soft resistance, the impression that there is something occupying the space, even if it is not completely solid.
It is not an illusion or a trick, Marco says.
Bailey's brow furrows in thought, but after a moment he nods. Poppet said nothing is impossible, and he finds he is beginning to agree.
I am not interacting with the surroundings as directly as you are, Marco continues. You and everything here appear equally insubstantial from my perspective. Perhaps we will be able to discuss it at greater length another time. Come with me.
He turns and begins walking toward the back of the tent. Bailey follows, taking a winding path around the animals. It is difficult to find places to step, though Marco glides ahead of him with much less difficulty. Bailey loses his balance, stepping around the prone figure of a polar bear. His shoulder knocks into a raven hanging in the air. The raven falls to the ground, its wings bent and broken. Before Bailey can say anything, Marco reaches down and picks up the raven, turning it over in his hands. He moves the broken wings and reaches inside, twisting something with a clicking noise. The raven turns its head and lets out a sharp metallic caw.
"How can you touch them?" Bailey asks.
"I am still figuring out the logistics of interacting with physical things," Marco says, flattening the raven's wings and letting it limp down the length of his arm. It flaps its paper feathers but cannot fly. "It likely has something to do with the fact that I made them. Elements of the circus I had a hand in creating seem to be more tangible."
The raven hops off by a mountainous pile of paper scales with a curling tail that looks as though it might once have been a dragon.
"They're amazing," Bailey says.
"They are paper and clockwork wrapped up in fairly simple charms. You could do the same with a bit of study."
It has never crossed Bailey's mind that he could do such things himself. But having been told as much so simply and directly, it seems strangely achievable.
"Where are we going?" Bailey asks
as they approach the far side of the tent.
"Someone would like to speak with you," Marco says. "She's waiting at the wishing tree. It seemed to be the most stable."
"I don't think I've seen the wishing tree," Bailey says, mindful of each step as they approach the other side of the tent.
"It is not a tent that is stumbled upon," Marco says. "It is found when it is needed. Instead, it is one of my favorite tents. You take a candle from the box at the entrance and light it from one that already burns on the tree. Your wish is ignited by someone else's wish."
They have reached the wall of the tent, and Marco indicates a break in the fabric, a barely visible row of ribbon ties that reminds Bailey of the entrance to Widget's tent with all the strange bottles.
"If you go out here, you will see the entrance to the acrobat tent across the way. I'll be right behind you, though you might not be able to see me until we're inside again. Be careful."
Bailey unties the bows and slips out of the tent easily, finding himself in a winding path between tents. The sky above is grey but bright, despite the soft rain that is beginning to fall. The acrobat tent looms higher than the tents surrounding it, and the sign that reads, "Defiance of Gravity," swings over the entrance only a few paces away. Bailey has been in this tent several times. He knows the open floor with the performers hanging above it well. But when he steps through the door, he is not met with the wide open space he expects. He walks into a party, a celebration that has been frozen in place, suspended the same way the paper birds had been in the air. There are dozens of performers throughout the tent, bathed with light from glowing round lamps that hang high above, amongst ropes and chairs and round cages. Some are standing in groups and pairs. Others sit on pillows and boxes and chairs that add flashes of colour to the predominantly black and white crowd. And each figure is perfectly still, so motionless that it seems they are not even breathing, like statues. One near Bailey has a flute at his lips, the instrument silent in his fingers. Another is pouring a bottle of wine, the liquid hovering above the glass.
"We should have gone around," Marco says, appearing like a shadow by his side. "I've been keeping an eye on them for hours, and they haven't gotten any less disturbing."
"What's wrong with them?" Bailey asks.
"Nothing, as far as I can tell," Marco answers. "The entirety of the circus has been suspended to give us more time, so..."
He lifts a hand and waves it over the party.
"Tsukiko's part of the circus, and she's not like this," Bailey says, confused.
"I believe she plays by her own rules," Marco says.
"This way," he adds,
moving into the crowd of figures. Navigating the party proves more difficult than walking around the paper animals, and Bailey takes every step with extreme caution, afraid of what might happen if he accidentally hits someone the way he knocked down the raven.
Almost there,
Marco says as they maneuver their way around a cluster of people grouped in a broken circle. But Bailey stops, staring at the figure the group is facing. Widget wears his performance costume, but his patchwork jacket has been discarded, his vest hanging open over his black shirt. His hands are lifted in the air, gesturing in such a familiar way that Bailey can tell he has been stopped mid-story. Poppet stands next to him. Her head is turned in the direction of the courtyard, as though something pulled her attention away from her brother at the precise moment the party was halted. Her hair spills out behind her, waves of red floating in the air, as if she were suspended in water. Bailey walks around to face her, reaching out tentatively to touch her hair. It ripples beneath his fingers, undulating slowly before settling back into its frozen state.
"Can she see me?" Bailey asks.
Poppet's eyes are still yet bright. He expects her to blink at any moment, but she does not.
"I don't know," Marco says. "Perhaps, but..."
Before he can conclude the thought, one of the chairs hanging above them falls, its ribbons snapping. It comes close to hitting Widget as it crashes to the ground, splintering into pieces.
"Bloody hell!"
Marco says as Bailey jumps back, almost colliding with Poppet and sending her hair into another brief wave of motion.
"Through there,"
Marco says, indicating the side of the tent that is some distance away. Then he vanishes. Bailey looks back at Poppet and Widget. Poppet's hair settles again, unmoving. Fragments of the fallen chair rest on Widget's boots. Turning away, Bailey moves carefully around stationary figures to reach the edge of the tent. He casts nervous glances upward at the additional chairs and the round iron cages suspended by nothing but fraying ribbon. His fingers shake as he undoes the ties in the wall. As soon as he passes through, he feels as though he has walked into a dream. Inside the adjoining tent, there is a towering tree, as large as his old oak tree, growing right out of the ground. The branches are bare and black, but they are covered with dripping white candles, translucent layers of wax frosting over the bark. Only a fraction of the candles are burning, but the sight is no less resplendent as they illuminate the twisting black branches, casting dancing shadows over the striped walls. Beneath it, Marco stands with his arms around a woman Bailey recognizes instantly as the illusionist. She appears as transparent as Marco does. Her gown looks like mist in the candlelight.
"Hello, Bailey," she says as he approaches.
Her voice echoes around him, softly, as close as if she were standing next to him, whispering in his ear.
"I like your scarf,"
she adds when he does not immediately reply. The words in his ears are warm and strangely comforting.
"I'm Celia. I don't believe we were ever properly introduced."
"Nice to meet you," Bailey says. Celia smiles, and Bailey is struck by how different she seems from the way she did when he watched her perform, even beyond the fact that he can look through her at the dark tree branches.
"How did you know I was coming here?" he asks. "Poppet mentioned you as part of the series of events that occurred earlier, so I hoped you would arrive eventually."
At the mention of Poppet's name, Bailey glances over his shoulder at the wall of the tent. The suspended party seems farther away than just beyond the canvas stripes.
"We need your help with something,"
Celia continues as he turns back.
"We need you to take over the circus."
"What?" Bailey asks. He is not sure what he was expecting, but it was not this.
"Right now the circus is in need of a new caretaker," Marco says. "It is drifting like a ship without an anchor. It needs someone to anchor it."
"And that someone is me?" Bailey asks.
"We would like it to be, yes," Celia says. "If you are willing to make the commitment, we should be able to assist you, and Poppet and Widget would be able to help as well.
but the true responsibility would be yours.
But I'm not special, Bailey says. Not the way they are. I'm not anyone important.
I know, Celia says. You're not destined or chosen. I wish I could tell you that you were, if that would make it easier. But it's not true. You're in the right place at the right time, and you care enough to do what needs to be done. Sometimes that's enough.
As he watches her in the flickering light, it strikes Bailey suddenly that she is a fair deal older than she appears, and that the same is likely true of Marco. It is like realizing someone in a photograph is no longer the same age as they were when it was taken, and they seem farther away because of it. The circus itself feels far away, even though he stands within it as though it is falling away from him.
All right, Bailey says, but Celia holds up a transparent hand to stop him before he agrees.
Wait, Celia says. This is important. I want you to have something neither of us truly had. I want you to have a choice. You can agree to this, or you can walk away. You are not obliged to help, and I don't want you to feel that you are.
What happens if I walk away? Bailey asks.
Celia looks at Marco before she answers. They only look at each other without speaking, but the gesture is so intimate that Bailey glances away, looking up at the twisting branches of the tree.
It won't last, Celia says after a moment.
She does not elaborate, turning back to Bailey as she continues.
I know this is a great deal to request from you, but I do not have anyone else to ask.
Suddenly the candles on the tree begin to spark. Some of them darken, curls of smoke replacing the bright flames only momentarily before disappearing themselves. Celia wavers, and for a moment Bailey thinks she might faint, but Marco steadies her.
Celia, love,
Marco says, running his hand over her hair.
You are the strongest person I have ever known. You can hold on for a while longer. I know you can.
I'm sorry,
Celia says. Bailey cannot tell which one of them she is speaking to.
You have nothing to be sorry about, Marco says.
Celia holds tightly to his hand.
What would happen to the two of you if the circus stopped? Bailey asks.
Truthfully, I'm not entirely certain, Celia says.
Nothing good, Marco mutters.
What would you need me to do? Bailey asks.
I need you to finish something I started, Celia says. I acted rather impulsively and played my cards out of order, and now there is the matter of the bonfire as well.
The bonfire? Bailey asks.
Think of the circus as a machine, Marco says. The bonfire is one of the things that powers it.
There are two things that need to happen, Celia says. First, the bonfire needs to be lit. That will power half the circus.
What about the other half? Bailey asks.
That's more complicated, Celia says. I carry that with me, and I would have to give that to you.
Oh,
you would then carry it with you, Celia says, all of the time. You'd be tied very tightly to the circus itself. You could leave, but not for extended periods of time.
I do not know if you would be able to give it to someone else. It would be yours, always.
It is only then that Bailey realizes the scope of the commitment he is being asked for. It is not the handful of years committed to Harvard. It is, he thinks, an even greater commitment than inheriting responsibility for the family farm. He looks from Marco to Celia and knows from the look in her eyes that she will let him go if he asks to leave, no matter what that might mean for them or the circus. He thinks of a litany of questions, but none of them truly matter. He knows his answer already. His choice was made when he was 10 years old, under a different tree, bound up in acorns and dares, and a single white glove. He will always choose the circus.
I'll do it, he says. I'll stay. I'll do whatever it is you need me to do.
Thank you, Bailey,
Celia says softly. The words resonating in his ears soothe the last of his nerves.
Indeed, Marco says. I think we should make this official.
Do you think that's absolutely necessary? Celia asks.
At this point, I'm not about to settle for a verbal contract, Marco says.
Celia frowns for a moment, but then nods her consent, and Marco carefully lets go of her hand. She stays steady and her appearance does not waver. Do you want me to sign something? Bailey asks.
Not exactly, Marco says.
He takes a silver ring from his right hand. It is engraved with something Bailey cannot discern in the light. Marco reaches up to a branch above his head and passes the ring through one of the burning candles until it glows white and hot. Bailey wonders whose wish that particular flame might be.
I made a wish on this tree years ago, Marco says,
as though he knows what Bailey is thinking.
What did you wish for? Bailey asks,
hoping it is not too forward a question, but Marco does not answer. Instead, he folds the glowing ring into his palm, and then he offers his hand to Bailey. Bailey hesitantly reaches out, expecting his fingers to pass through Marco's hand as easily as they did before. But instead, they stop, and Marco's hand in his is almost solid. Marco leans forward and whispers into Bailey's ear.
I wished for her, he says.
Then Bailey's hand begins to hurt. The pain is bright and hot as the ring burns into his skin.
What are you doing?
He manages to ask when he can gasp for enough air. The pain is sharp and searing, coursing through his entire body, and he is barely able to keep his knees from buckling beneath him.
Binding, Marco says, is one of my specialties.
He releases Bailey's hand. The pain vanishes instantly, but Bailey's legs continue to tremble.
Are you all right? Celia asks.
Bailey nods, looking down at his palm. The ring is gone, but there is a bright red circle burned into his skin. Bailey is certain, without having to ask, that it will be a scar he carries with him, always. He closes his hand and looks back at Marco and Celia.
Tell me what I need to do now, he says.
The second lighting of the bonfire. New York, November 1, 1902. Bailey finds the tiny book-filled room without much difficulty. The large black raven sitting in the corner blinks at him curiously as he sorts through the contents of the desk. He flips anxiously through the large leather book until he finds the page with Poppet's and Widget's signatures. He tears the page from the binding carefully, removing it completely. He finds a pen in a drawer and writes his own name across the page as he has been instructed. While the ink dries, he gathers up the rest of the things he will need, running through the list over and over in his head so he does not forget anything. The yarn is easily found. A ball of it sits precariously on a pile of books. The two cards, one a familiar playing card and the other a tarot card emblazoned with an angel, are amongst the papers on the desk. He tucks these into the front cover of the book. The doves in the cage above him stir with a soft fluttering of feathers. The pocket watch on its long silver chain proves most difficult to locate. He finds it on the ground beside the desk, and when he attempts to dust it off a bit, he can see the initials HB engraved on the back. The watch no longer ticks. Bailey places the loose page on top of the book and tucks it under his arm. The watch and the yarn he puts in his pockets with the candle he pulled from the wishing tree. The raven cocks its head at him as he leaves. The doves remain asleep. Bailey crosses the adjoining tent. Walking around the double circle of chairs as passing directly through it does not seem appropriate. Outside, the light rain is still falling. He hurries back to the courtyard where he finds Tsukiko waiting for him.
Celia says I need to borrow your lighter, he says.
Tsukiko tilts her head curiously, looking oddly like a bird with a cat-like grin.
I suppose that is acceptable, she says after a moment.
She pulls the silver lighter from her coat pocket and tosses it to him. It is heavier than he had expected, a complicated mechanism of gears partially encased in worn and tarnished silver, with symbols he cannot distinguish etched into the surface.
"Be careful with that," Tsukiko says.
"Is it magic?"
Bailey asks, turning it over in his hand.
"No, but it is old and it was constructed by someone very dear to me. I take it you are attempting to light that again?"
She gestures at the towering bowl of twisted metal that once held the bonfire. Bailey nods.
"Do you want any help?
Are you offering?" Tsukiko shrugs.
"I am not terribly invested in the outcome," she says,
but something about the way she looks around at the tents and the mud makes Bailey doubt her words.
"I don't believe you," he says, "but I am, and I think I should do this on my own."
Tsukiko smiles at him, the first smile he has seen from her that seems genuine.
"I shall leave you to it, then," she says.
She runs a hand along the iron cauldron, and most of the rainwater within it turns to steam, rising in a soft cloud that dissipates into the fog. With no further advice or instruction, she walks off down a black-and-white striped path, a thin curl of smoke trailing behind her, leaving Bailey alone in the courtyard. He remembers Widget telling him the story of the lighting of the bonfire, the first lighting, though he only now realizes that it was also the night that Widget was born. He had told the story in such detail that Bailey assumed he had witnessed it firsthand, the arches, the colors, the spectacle. And now here Bailey stands, trying to accomplish the same feat with only a book and some yarn and a borrowed cigarette lighter, alone in the rain. He mumbles to himself what he can remember of Celia's instructions, the ones that are more complicated than finding books and tying strings. Things about focus and intent that he does not entirely understand. He wraps the book with a length of fine wool yarn dyed a deep crimson, bits of it stained darker with something dried and brown. He knots it three times, binding the book closed with a loose page against the cover, the cards securely pressed inside. The pocket watch he hangs around it, looping the chain as best he can. He throws it in the empty cauldron where it lands with a dull, wet thud, the watch clattering against the metal. Marco's bowler hat sits in the mud by his feet. He throws that in as well. He glances back in the direction of the acrobat tent. He can see the top of it from the courtyard, rising taller than the surrounding tents. And then, impulsively, he takes out the remaining contents of his pockets and adds them to the collection in the cauldron. His silver ticket, the dried rose that he had worn in his lapel at dinner with the Rivers, Poppet's white glove. He hesitates, turning the tiny glass bottle with Widget's version of his tree trapped inside over in his hand. But then he adds it as well, flinching as it shatters against the iron. He takes the single white candle in one hand and Tsukiko's lighter in the other. He fumbles with the lighter before it consents to spark. Then he ignites the candle with a bright orange flame. He throws the burning candle into the cauldron. Nothing happens.
"I choose this," Bailey thinks. "I want this. I need this. Please, please let this work."
He wishes it, harder than he has ever wished for anything over birthday candles or on shooting stars, wishing for himself, for the Rivers in their red scarves, for a clockmaker he never met, for Celia and Marco and Poppet and Widget and even for Tsukiko, though she claims she does not care. Bailey closes his eyes. For a moment, everything is still. Even the light rain suddenly stops. He feels a pair of hands resting on his shoulders, a heaviness in his chest. Something within the twisted iron cauldron begins to spark. When the flames catch, they are bright and crimson. When they turn to white, they are blinding and the shower of sparks falls like stars. The force of the heat pushes Bailey backward, moving through him like a wave, the air burning hot in his lungs. He falls onto ground that is no longer charred and muddy, but firm and dry, and patterned in a spiral of black and white. All around him, lights are popping to life along the tents, flickering like fireflies. Marco stands beneath the wishing tree, watching as the candles come